Well, what a great story that we've just read together from Mark chapter 9. Greater, of course, because it's not a made-up story or a fable or a myth. But these events where Jesus healed this boy and spoke to his father actually happened in history. Now, what we find in this story is that as Jesus comes down from the mountain with three of his disciples, the remaining number of disciples have been trying to heal a boy who's been terribly afflicted. The father has asked them to help. Jesus and his disciples have obviously got a strong reputation of being able to help people in great trouble. But actually, these disciples, without Jesus, have been unable to do what the man has asked for. And it's caused a great commotion in the small crowd that has gathered together. And this boy's affliction is such that he has a demon, we're told, a spirit, that means the boy can't speak. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why the father is asking for help. The boy simply can't ask for himself. And whenever this spirit seizes the boy, according to what we're told, it throws him to the ground and he foams at the knife and he becomes rigid. And Jesus sees this inability to heal this boy and he says, "You unbelieving generation." It seems that he's not just speaking there to his disciples, but perhaps more broadly. He doesn't say, "You unbelieving disciples." He doesn't say, "You unbelieving father." He says, "You unbelieving generation." The problem of unbelief seems to be wide. But he also says, to the great hope perhaps of the man who's brought the boy, "Bring him to me." So the boy comes. And immediately, without Jesus even saying a word, the spirit throws the boy into a convulsion. And exactly what the father has said often happens, it happens now in Jesus' presence. Jesus then asks, well, has this always happened? Yes, it's happened from childhood, the father says. Sometimes it's so bad that he's thrown into water or fire. It's as if the spirit wants to kill him. "But if you can do anything," the father says, "take pity on us and help us." Jesus now takes exception to what the dad has said. He didn't like one word. He didn't like the word "if." "If you can," Jesus says, "everything is possible for the one who believes." So the boy's father now, he wants to believe in Jesus. He wants not to say, "If you can." He wants to be able to say, "I really believe you can." He wants to say, "I believe with all my heart that you can do this, Jesus. Will you do it for me?" That's what he wants to say. But this man is a man of integrity. This man is a man who's not just going to say what he thinks Jesus wants to hear. He probably knows that Jesus can see into his heart and that there's no fooling with Jesus. So he's honest. Wonderfully, gloriously honest. This man is one of my heroes of the New Testament because he says this, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." Can you relate to that? This man's prayer is probably a prayer I pray more than any other almost. "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." And what the man is confessing there, it seems, is that he's trying hard to believe that Jesus is able to help this boy of his, to help his son. He perhaps believes that Jesus is more able than anyone else, but he can't quite yet say with all of his heart that "I believe that Jesus absolutely, definitely can do anything that I need." Not quite able to say that. But here's what he does understand. And here's what's wonderful. He understands that what he needs right now is to believe. And he's starting to believe that Jesus can do anything that he needs. So he puts two and two together. And he gets four. And he realizes that if what he needs is faith, and if Jesus is saying that he can do anything that this man needs. Well, if he can't quite yet believe that he's able to heal his son, he can at least believe that Jesus is able to give him the faith to believe that Jesus is able to heal his son. And for this man, therefore, the answer to his prayer will come not just in one step, but in two. And that's, I think, why I find this story so wonderfully helpful. Because so often in my Christian experience, I can't get to where I need to go in just one step. Often I need two, or three, or four, or five. Sometimes I feel it's a whole lifetime of steps. But what this man discovered is that Jesus is willing to take us through those steps and to help us on our way and to give us what we need in every step of the journey. And therefore, this man was to find that Jesus was able to answer his prayer. And you see, as we come to this story, we find ourselves, I really believe this, we find ourselves in very similar situations to the one that this father found himself in. We find ourselves with great, great needs. We find ourselves in situations where no one can help us. Perhaps someone's come to us for advice or comfort. And as they come and explain their story and the great difficulty and troubles that they've got, we think to ourselves, we perhaps are not honest enough to say this out loud, but we think sometimes to ourselves, well, if I'm honest, I can't really help. The problem you've got is so serious and so difficult. I can put my arm round your shoulder. I can be with you in your distress. But actually, I can't help your real deepest need. Maybe you felt that as other people have unburdened themselves to you. Or maybe you felt that yourself. You've got some great need, and actually you know that no one can help. And because of that, maybe this need is lain within. You dare not even speak it, lest it becomes more real. Because you know there's no point going to a doctor. No point even going to a priest. Because no one can help with a problem that you've got. Or at least, no one has been able to help. But this story gives us hope, doesn't it? That maybe there is one who perhaps can help. And as we look at this story in more detail, therefore, this morning, what I want us to do is to see and to give ourselves hope, or to take hope from the way in which Jesus dealt with this man. And to see that Jesus really can help. Whatever your struggle, whatever your deepest need, Jesus can help. And you may feel at the moment, well, I just can't yet put all my trust in Jesus Christ. I can't yet believe that he's able to deal with this. No one else has been able to help. He's been with me for all of this time. I'd love to think that Jesus can help, but I can't quite bring myself to believe it. If that's the situation you're in, you'll find this story wonderfully, wonderfully helpful. But before we look at it in detail, we need to acknowledge, don't we, that as we look at this story, Jesus here takes the existence of demonic power as a simple fact of life. And I want to pull that out and address it just by way of introduction, because that's a belief, perhaps, that nowadays is diminishing day by day. And fewer people, perhaps, believe in the existence of demonic power. But as far as Jesus is concerned, yeah, of course there is. Yeah, of course there is. And that's actually still the case today. It's the only way, really, to explain some of the things that happen in this world. Evil is the only way to explain that, isn't it? And certainly there is evil within us. We don't need demons to make us evil, do we? It's part of our nature. But there are also things that go on that perhaps are difficult to explain without also seeing it's not just the evil within us, but there is an evil without us as well. There is an evil influence in the world, a personal evil influence in the world, through Satan and his demons. Now, in Jesus' day, particularly during the time when Jesus was involved in his ministry, demonic activity tended to be manifest, to be shown through physical oppression. You can see this here very clearly, can't you? So this boy had a demon. How did people know that he had a demon? Well, they knew that he had a demon because there were physical manifestations of it. We're told what they were. Firstly, he couldn't speak. Physical manifestation. He was thrown to the ground. Physical manifestation. He foamed at the mouth. Physical manifestation. He gnashed his teeth. Physical manifestation. He became rigid. It's a physical manifestation. What Jesus is saying here, the root cause of that in this boy's case is something spiritual, but it's showing itself in a physical manifestation. If you were here in Growing Together on Monday night, you'll realize that actually this is quite common in the Old Testament, or the things that happened before, at least, Jesus Christ had died on the cross for us. What we often find in that period is that spiritual reality is seen through physical manifestations. You can see that right throughout the Bible. So, for example, when God withdraws his spiritual blessings from people in the Old Testament, one of the ways in which that was seen, for example, was through oppression from a foreign military power. Spiritual problem, unbelief, but it showed itself in physical manifestations. Or it showed itself in a drought or a famine. Again, a spiritual problem, but God says, if you don't put your trust in me, I'll withdraw the rain from you, and you'll see there what the problem is. That's how things tended to work in that period. But in the New Testament age, the age in which we live, things have changed. Jesus has done something. He's done something by dying on the cross, raising from the dead. He now has this spiritual resurrection body. The Holy Spirit has been given at Pentecost, and now we live in much more of a spiritual age. And we see in this age much more spiritual blessings and curses than physical ones. So when we think, therefore, of the blessings and so on that we receive as Christians, we tend not to think, do we, well, God has blessed me because he's kept me faithful, and to show that he's kept me faithful and that he's pleased with me, he's given me a bumper harvest this year. We tend not to think like that, do we? We're much more likely to think that the Lord has blessed me by giving me peace and joy and fulfillment and a closeness to him, even if the harvest wasn't very fruitful. Do you see, in this day and generation, in this New Testament age, we tend to see spiritual manifestations, therefore, much more than physical ones. And what that means in this day and age, therefore, is the demonic activity that is around us, and it still is much more likely to show itself in spiritual ways than actually in physical ways. So, what does the New Testament kind of tell us about what the devil does and what demonic activity happens in this day and generation? He don't really get in the New Testament much of an idea that the demonic influence will cause the sorts of thing that Jesus was dealing with here. What does the New Testament teach us that the devil does? That Satan does? That the forces in this world, the powers in this world do? Well, one example would be he blinds the minds of unbelievers. Do you see? It's a spiritual thing. It's spiritual oppression. And because of that, many people in our world don't believe that the demon exists, that demons exist and that Satan exists. There are people today, scientists and so on, who say, well, the reason that people used to believe in those things but don't believe anymore is because we're much more grown up and mature now, and we've moved on from those silly stories of our forefathers. But actually, that's not the case at all. The reason why people used to believe those things much more than they do now is because those things used to show themselves in physical ways which people could see. But now, because of the change that has been brought about by Christ on the cross and the Spirit coming at Pentecost, Satan's changed his tactics somewhat. And he now works much more in a spiritual way. Because that's what Jesus does, and Satan is a great imitator. And he now oppresses in a much more spiritual way, perhaps, than he was doing before in Old Testament days. And people who are not spiritually aware and spiritually alert just don't see it. They just don't see it. That's why people today are less likely to believe in demons and in Satan than we were generations ago. Not because we're cleverer now, but because, in a sense, Satan is cleverer now, because he's imitating what God the Holy Spirit does in a way. Well, that means, therefore, that we ought to be careful as we interpret and apply this passage. We ought to make sure that we don't make the mistake of thinking that every time somebody is ill, either physically or perhaps with a psychiatric or psychological issue, that the devil is at work. We ought not to think that someone, for example, who has epilepsy, which looks perhaps a little bit like this episode here, or some kind of seizures, we certainly shouldn't make the mistake of saying that person's possessed by a demon. Tragically, there are some very immature or very badly taught people who come to that conclusion, but it's not at all what the Bible teaches. And we need to make very clear we're not making that mistake. So if we're going to apply this passage to ourselves, we need to think, therefore, not simply about our physical problems or our psychological problems, but we need to think about our spiritual problems. We need to think about our spiritual battles. And as we look at this story, we'll learn from this story how we can overcome our spiritual battles. Those problems of doubt and of unbelief. And in fact, as we see this story, we realize, actually, that's what this story is about. This story is not about, really, the boy who was healed from a demon. It's much more about a father who was rescued from unbelief. And we struggle today, don't we, through doubt and unbelief. And I'm not saying that those who doubt or struggle to believe are possessed by the devil. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that that is the devil's work. I am saying that that's what the devil longs to do. I am saying that he loves us to doubt God. He loves us not to believe in what the Lord can do. And he is involved in a spiritual battle, and we may not know it. We may not realize it, but because he's involved in a spiritual battle, then every one of us is too. So how do we overcome those spiritual battles? How are we able to overcome when there is so much that is set against us? Three things that we can learn from this passage. Three things that will help us. Here's the first one. We can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power. We can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power. I'm looking particularly now at verses 28 and 29. Because in those verses, the disciples who've been trying to help this boy when Jesus was on the mountain, they come to Jesus and they ask him this question, well, why couldn't we drive it out? It seemed so easy, Jesus, when you came along, but why couldn't we do it? And Jesus gives the answer, this kind can only come out by prayer. This kind can only come out by prayer. In other words, what Jesus was saying here, that they weren't addressing this problem in a spiritual way. Prayer really gets us to the heart of a spiritual battle, doesn't it? There's nothing physical, really, about prayer at all. It takes us into a spiritual realm. We often close our eyes, don't we? In order to, as it were, block out the physical world around us. We often go into a quiet place so that we can, again, with our ears, block out the world around us. We remember that world and pray for that world, but we're taken, in a sense, to a spiritual place. That's what prayer is all about. We're coming to the throne of grace, entering into the presence of our Father. It's a spiritual act. It might even be the most spiritual thing that we do. But the disciples didn't do it. We don't know how they were trying to cast out this demon. We don't know how they were trying to deal with it. But Jesus picks out particularly, you didn't pray. You weren't praying, and without prayer, you're not going to win this spiritual battle. You see, every one of us needs something outside of ourselves. We need to recognize that we don't have the power on our own, that we're not able to fix things. We're certainly not able to fix everything. And the mistake that the disciples made was that they felt they could fix this boy. They could fix this problem. They'd looked at Jesus, they'd seen what he did, he trained them up to a sense. Although clearly they hadn't paid as much attention as quite they ought to have done if they didn't think that praying might help. And they looked at what Jesus did, and they realized that that he had gifted them in a sense, and he'd given them a commission, and they thought that they could fix the problem. And we often make the very same mistake, don't we? We perhaps look at the Bible and the examples that are there for us in the Bible. And we see how maybe somebody like David was able to slay Goliath. And we think, if only I can follow the example of David, I'll be able to slay the great problems that are in my life, and I'll be able to be powerful. And we try and follow David's example. And what happens when you try and follow David's example? You fail, don't you? Just as I do, and actually just as David did at times in his life too. You see, if we read the Bible and simply think, well, we can follow the example of these people, and we can follow the example of Jesus, but we don't see our need for spiritual power, then we'll fail every time. We've been thinking on the Sunday evenings about how we can change. And the big emphasis in that series all along has been to say, on our own, we can't change. We can only change when God works in us. We need to remember that. We can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power. And the Father made the same mistake too. He didn't think that he could fix the problem. He knew that he couldn't fix the problem. But he thought these ordinary human beings, these other disciples, could fix the problem. And he went to them. But they couldn't fix it either. And again, we often make that same mistake. We've got a problem and we think, well, perhaps sometimes we think, I can fix this. And eventually we end up into all sorts of a mess. And then we think, oh, I've learned my lesson from that. I now believe I can't fix it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask other people for help. And depending on who we are, we might go and see our husband or our wife, or we might go and see another family member. We might go and speak to a good friend. Or we might speak to our parents, perhaps. That we might go and see a doctor or a psychiatrist. You might even come to a minister and you say, I need help. Well, listen, it's a good thing to ask for help. It's a good thing to be humble and to recognize we can't fix everything ourselves. That's a great step. But ultimately, it's not enough. Because you don't simply need the wisdom, let's say, of your parents, your husband or wife, or some other member of your family or your friend. You don't just need their wisdom. You don't just need some tablets or treatment from the doctor. Might help, but you don't just need that. You don't just need some counseling, whether that's secular counseling from a psychiatrist or spiritual counseling from me or someone like me. You don't just need that. Now, those things can all help in different circumstances and different situations. I'm certainly not saying never ask anyone for advice, never go and see the doctor, never go and see the mental health service, never come and see a minister. I'm certainly not saying that. But I am saying that all of those things can only ever be part of the solution. And we can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power. One of the reasons, you see, why the NHS is in crisis, if we believe everything that we're told, is not just because its funding's been cut, although you know that that's true, but it's actually because the NHS doesn't and perhaps can't recognise that there are spiritual elements to many of the problems that are presented to them. Some people go time and time and time and time again to see the doctor. Sometimes because they've got a chronic condition. And of course, if we've got a chronic condition, that's what we need to do. But there are many other people, actually, who have what one doctor I know calls tough life syndrome. Life's just really tough and really difficult. And perhaps they haven't got anyone to help apart from the doctor. They know they can make an appointment and they'll get 15 minutes of his time. And perhaps in a small little way he'll make them feel better. But actually their problem perhaps is much more deep-rooted than that. And if the doctor was only able to say so, he'd be able to point out perhaps some spiritual issues that are also a problem. Maybe problems of doubt in God's power. Maybe problems of doubt in God's love. Maybe the problem of even doubting God's existence at all, and therefore getting so frustrated that there's nobody who can help when actually there's one who can. You see, there is so often a spiritual element to all of our problems. So when we're struggling and when we need help, I absolutely want to encourage you to go and see your GP. Go and see a psychiatrist if you're struggling psychologically. See a minister, or one of the elders, or a trusted Christian friend, yes. But you need the NHS plus spiritual power. You need the mental health service plus spiritual power. You need a minister or a spiritual counselor plus spiritual power, you see? You can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power. That's the first thing I think we learn from this passage. Here now is the second lesson that we can learn from this passage. Not just that we can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power, but secondly, we can't win spiritual battles without the right faith. We can't win spiritual battles without the right faith. I'm thinking here of verse 19 and then verses 22 through to 24. You see, in verse 19, Jesus singles out there the problem that this generation has. What's the problem? You're an unbelieving generation. You don't have enough faith. Or actually, perhaps more accurately, you don't have the right sort of faith. Because these people did have faith, didn't they? These people had faith in the disciples. They thought the disciples could help. But that's not the right sort of faith. Because they're putting their faith in men. And that's not enough. Because this is a spiritual battle and it needs a spiritual answer. And therefore that's not the right kind of faith, because it's not faith that is really spiritual. It's just faith in men. And if we put faith in men or faith in women, well, that's fine for certain things, but it won't win you any spiritual battles. And then in verses 22 to 24, the issue of faith comes up again. Because there the man says, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And clearly the man was convinced that Jesus could do some things. But he wasn't convinced that Jesus could do anything to help. He thought that there were certain things that are outside of Jesus' control and outside of Jesus' influence. And Jesus takes exception to this. If you can, he says, everything is possible for the one who believes. He's pointing out the spiritual problem that this man's got is exactly the same as the one he identified at the problem at the beginning. The problem is unbelief. That's the problem. You need faith. Well, this man did have faith. He had faith that Jesus could do many things that he needed. That's quite a lot of faith, isn't it? That's quite a lot of faith. It's more faith than many people have got today. It's quite a lot of faith. But it's not the right sort of faith. Because Jesus says here that the right sort of faith is not just faith in the right person, not the disciples, but Jesus, but also the right kind of faith. Not just faith that Jesus can do some things, but that Jesus can do anything. We can't win spiritual battles without the right faith. Now, this man, I admire him greatly. I see myself in him in some ways, many ways. And this guy had a lot of faith, but it was the wrong kind of faith. He had more faith than he should have done in the disciples. He really thought they could help. But actually they couldn't do anything. And he had less faith than he should in Jesus. He thought he could do some things, but not this. And you see, again, that's the mistake that you and I often make. We often have more faith in the people and the systems that we see around us than perhaps we should do. Sometimes we think, don't we, that our NHS service can solve almost any problem. And it's an incredible shock to us when we go to the doctor and they say, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. Doesn't that come as a great shock? That ever happens to you? Because you've gone there in faith thinking, well, that's what doctors do. They heal people. That's what I need. And it's a great shock when the doctor says, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. We have perhaps more faith than we should in people. We're perhaps surprised. Do you remember the first time, maybe as a child, when you went to mum or dad with a problem and they'd fixed everything in your life? And then you got to an age where the problems that you were now experiencing were problems that they couldn't help with. Do you remember that first time your parents said, I'm sorry, I can't help with this? What a great surprise that can be. Often we have more faith than we should in people and less faith than we should in Jesus. Because very often we go to other people and only to other people for help. Or we try and fix it ourselves and don't even ask anyone else. But you see, what we need to do is to realize the spiritual element in so many of our problems. In the health service and the mental health service, people speak, don't they, about comorbidity. You come across that little word, comorbidity. It means simply that if you're suffering from one particular problem, it's quite likely that a whole bunch of other problems are going to come along with it. And actually, it's like that on the bigger scale as well. If we're suffering from something physical, it's quite likely, actually, that spiritual problems will come right alongside. If we're suffering from something psychological, it's quite likely, even more likely perhaps, that spiritual problems will come alongside. So, for example, if you're suffering from chronic pain, and all day, every day, you're in pain, is that going to affect you spiritually? Of course it is. Of course it is. As human beings, we're made up of body and soul. You can't separate them, except at death, of course. In this life, we can't separate them. And when there's problems with our bodies, yes, of course, it can affect our soul. Sometimes in good ways, often actually in bad ways. And therefore we can get spiritually depressed, perhaps, when we're suffering from chronic pain or other issues like that. It's the same with our mental health. We can suffer perhaps from depression or anxiety and so on. And in a sense, it's a psychological problem. But actually, it often brings with it spiritual issues too. And it even works both ways. Sometimes when we're spiritually oppressed, it will manifest itself in physical ways. Have there been times when you felt a real spiritual oppression? That God is distant from you? And that you need him desperately, but however you try and do that, you just somehow can't know his presence. And you yearn for him and long for him. But for whatever reason, God just seems distant, and you're convinced it's a spiritual problem. But over time, perhaps, you start to feel physical symptoms. You start to get tired and lethargic. You might start to get headaches or so on. You might stop eating, perhaps, or not eat as well as you used to. You might start to develop some psychiatric problems, too, alongside it. It's comorbidity. These things go together. And therefore, whatever our problem, we need a spiritual answer. You see, this man made the mistake of thinking that Jesus could help with some things. But what he had to learn was that Jesus can help with anything. And we can often make the same mistake. Those of you who are Christians can often think, well, if I need my sins forgiven, Jesus can help with that. But what about the problems in your family? What about the problems with your health? What about the difficulties you're experiencing at work? What about the disappointments and the discouragements? What about that neighbor who just makes your life a misery? Can Jesus help with that? Jesus can help with anything. But we need to understand, too, that the way in which Jesus helps is very often in a spiritual way. So, what's Jesus going to do about your neighbor? Well, in theory, I suppose, Jesus could send a lightning bolt from heaven. That would solve the problem if he directed the lightning bolt in just the right place. We get occasions in the Bible when people pray like that, don't we? But it's much more likely that actually Jesus will solve that problem in a spiritual way. If you've got a terrible neighbor, what do you need? We're tempted to limit our understanding. I think, well, I need the neighbor to move. Perhaps not a lightning bolt, but at least make them move. Get the council to evict them. But actually, Jesus may well say, no, what you need is patience and peace, joy, long-suffering, and more of the fruit of the Spirit. You see, we can't win spiritual battles without the right faith. But it's vital that we understand in that actually all of our battles have a spiritual element. And that's actually a wonderfully encouraging thing. Because it helps us to understand perhaps why sometimes we struggle spiritually when we're physically or emotionally exhausted. But it also helps us because it means that Jesus is able to help us in every area of our lives. Because all these different areas of our lives have a spiritual aspect. So we've seen already that we can't win spiritual battles without spiritual power. We can't win spiritual battles without the right faith. And now, finally, we're going to see that we can't win spiritual battles without someone to fight for us. Without someone to fight for us. You see, as we said, this man was called to believe not that Jesus might be able to help, but actually that he definitely could help. And that he was the only one who could help. That's what this man needed to believe. He needed to understand that. He needed to understand, in other words, this is not actually, in this case, a physical problem. At its root, this, on this occasion, is a spiritual problem. And for this spiritual problem, only Jesus can help. And for the spiritual problems that you experience and I, and the spiritual aspects of the problems that all of us face, only Jesus can help. So yes, go and see a doctor if you're in pain. Don't put that off, please, don't put that off. But remember too that the spiritual aspect of that problem, only Jesus can help with. And how does Jesus help this man? There's something absolutely fascinating about this story, something that I love. A little detail, perhaps, that often we miss. At the end of the story, Jesus criticizes the disciples for what? For not praying. How does Jesus fix the problem? Well, I say this, he doesn't pray. So Jesus says to the disciples, the only way you can fix this problem is with prayer. But he also implies that he doesn't need to pray. So what does that teach us about Jesus? It teaches us that Jesus is not like us. When we have a spiritual problem, we need to ask God to help. When Jesus has a spiritual problem, he's able to help because he is divine. He is God. Now, I'm not saying Jesus never prayed. Of course, we know that he did because he's in relationship with his Father. But he also had this power of his own, this spiritual power, because he was divine. You see, therefore, what this all helps us to understand is that actually what you and I need is not just more strength, let's say. We pray for that, and we're right to pray for that. But more strength on its own will not actually help you win your spiritual battles. Because however much you're strengthened, you won't be strong enough. You don't just need more righteousness, because however much righteousness God gives and however much he helps you to live a holy life, it actually won't be enough. You'll never be holy enough. You see, what we need is not just more of that spiritual fruit, although certainly we need that, but what you and I actually need is someone to fight for us. And that's how Jesus concluded this episode, wasn't he? Because he says in verses 28 and to the end that he began teaching his disciples, saying, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They'll kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." They didn't understand that at that time. They understood it later, of course, when it happened. They understood it when Jesus Christ raised from the dead and they realized that sin had been defeated and Satan had been defeated and that the Holy Spirit was now going to be given. They understood it then, but not now. Because what Jesus was telling them and helping them to understand was that there are some spiritual battles that you and I simply cannot win. And we ultimately cannot win the battle against Satan. Ultimately, we cannot win the battle against sin. Ultimately, we cannot win the battle against death. Ultimately, you and I cannot win those battles, the spiritual battles, outside of our abilities. And we can't win those spiritual battles without someone to fight for us. There are some things where we need someone alongside us, but there are other things when we need someone to fight for us. And this story reminds us that on that great occasion, 2,000 years ago, as Jesus brought his earthly ministry to a climax, he wasn't now working alongside the disciples. They'd all left him. Where he was going, they couldn't immediately follow. He was going to the cross. He was going to pay the punishment for their sin and ours if we trust in him. And as Jesus walked up that hill to the cross, he walked there alone, deserted. He walked there knowing that he was fighting this battle for all those who would put their trust in him. You see, our greatest spiritual need is for our sins to be forgiven. Our greatest spiritual need is for us to be able to believe that Jesus and Jesus alone can solve that greatest of all problems. Our greatest spiritual need is to believe and to trust in Christ alone. That's our greatest need. I wonder, do you do that? Do you trust in Jesus Christ alone? And if you're a Christian, you'll say, "Yeah, I do." But actually, you'll also say, "But no, I don't." Because maybe we do in theory, and maybe we do most of the time, but there comes times in all of our lives where actually we stop believing. We stop believing that what Jesus wants is best for us, and because of that, we do our own thing. We stop believing that we can trust God no matter what happens. And then we get angry or depressed when bad things occur. We believe, but we still have unbelief. It's a massive spiritual problem that you all face. But here's the answer. Our greatest need, perhaps, therefore, is to trust in the Lord Jesus Christ with all of our hearts. Can you do that? I'd love to be able to do that. But I can't. Not with all of my heart. So, Lord, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And the Lord then, little by little, and step by step, and eventually yard by yard and mile by mile, I find that the Lord, as He did with this man, He brings me on. He helps me to grow. And day by day I trust that I'm able to believe even more. And I put even more trust in Him. And as He works in my life and I can see Him at work, that gives me cause to believe and cause to have faith and cause to trust. And so we get this wonderful, wonderful circle. Not a vicious circle, but a virtuous circle. Christ working in our lives, helping us to trust Him more and more each day, so that we really are able to know with all of our hearts He is utterly and absolutely trustworthy, and there's no need that you have that He cannot meet. Do you believe that? If you do, trust Him. And if you struggle, trust Him.